This program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Joanna LaForgia from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading from the December 2025 issue of Southern Living magazine. This week, we will start with the editor's essay, Life at SL, which is at the front of every issue of the magazine. And then we'll go on to the story of the Southerner of the Year, The Triumph of Lulu Gribben, how a teenage girl from Mountain Brook, Alabama, turned tragedy into purpose. And we'll begin with a description of the cover. It has a pink background, pink fabric wallpaper. It's a bright pink, but a soft pink as well. It's the color of promise and hope, and the color of the blush of someone that you perhaps flattered but did not embarrass too much. So they didn't turn red. It's just a soft blush pink. And in the foreground, there is a cake sitting on a white pedestal ceramic plate. And surrounding that plate are some ceramic Christmas trees of various sizes. They are in various shades of green. Mint green, forest green, emerald green one is, and white too. There's some that are white and that are more textured. The cake facing us is, the cake has, it's white frosted, and it's got doors that go all around the cake. And the three doors facing us are, from left to right, there's one that is mint green. It has two vertical panels on the bottom and one horizontal panel on the top. And above that is an arched window. This is all frosting, of course, green frosting upon a cookie. And then there's a green Christmas wreath on that, hanging from that window, and some red beads of some sort that decorate the Christmas wreath. And there's a terracotta, a cookie-colored bar that represents a letterbox. And then the doorknob there's a gold bead for the doorknob. The door in the center facing us is that colored pink, and it's a double door. It's an arched door, and there are three panels on either side, and the top panels of these two arched doors have some mistletoe frosted on them. So there are two green leaves and a red bead of some sort in the center. And then there are those two gold beads representing the doorknobs. And then in front of this door is a potted plant. It's got terracotta-colored frosting. And the plant goes up almost to the vertical half of the door, and almost to the horizontal half of the double doors, almost covers one the door on the left that we're looking at. And the plant has very thickly frosted, lush green leaves, forest green colored leaves. The door on the right facing us is red, but it's mostly glass paint, the glass represented by white frosting. And there are five panes on either side, so it's a 10-paned door. And there's some garland hanging on it from the top and going down the sides about halfway down the door. The garland is green frosting with some red beads or red frosting and some terracotta-colored gold bows on each corner of the door holding it up, holding the garland up. And, of course, the gold bead doorknob there. Now, on top of this very high white frosted cake is a church of some sort. Might be a church. It looks to be, it's because it has a pitched, it's pink, and it has a pitched roof, and it has white double doors with the gold bead doorknobs. And just above those, there is a round window, that, and there is a cross in it. It could be gold, the gold trim of four window panes, but the window is terracotta colored. So it could also, it's a gold cross, and then it's a green Christmas wreath surrounding this circular window with red beads on it. And the pitched roof of this pink structure, this pink little structure, the pitched roof is covered in white frosted snow that's dripping from the roof. And then right on top of it in the center, right on top of the peak, is a pitched chimney that goes, forms a steeple of some sort. And that chimney also has white frosting on the top of it that's dripping down. And at the top of the chimney is a gold star that appears to be a continuation of the cookie or whatever that structure is made of there. On either side of that little pink church or little pink structure are Christmas trees. And they are green and they're just as high, almost as high as the top of that chimney, each one of them. They're green with white and green leaves that are scattered around the tree and green bulbs that match those doorknobs we talked about, little green beads of some sort. And then at the top, a continuation of these Christmas tree cookies, it forms a star, a white star. But then also at the top of the green tree, there are small gold stars. The print of the cover from top to bottom, the top is in red print, Southern Living. The rest is black print. It says mahogany cake with ermine frosting and Charleston door cookies. Home for the holidays, the magic of a low country Christmas. And then across the bottom, listeners, high spirits in Beaufort, South Carolina, making merry at the Peabody Hotel, fun and festive decor ideas. And then across the bottom it says, plus truffles, pies, and cookies. Oh my! December 2025. And for those of you who may not be local to the Carolinas, Beaufort is spelled B-E-A-U-F-O-R-T. And there's a town that's spelled the same way in North Carolina. But in South Carolina, that word is pronounced Beaufort. And in North Carolina, it's pronounced Beaufort, which I'm guessing many of you know, maybe not all. All right, are we ready? Life at SL. And this is the essay of the editor that begins each issue. And this always begins with a quote. Here's this month's quote. It's not what's under the Christmas tree that matters. It's who's around it. And that's by Charles M. Schulz. Life at SL. A room full of memories. There was nothing better than Christmas Eve at Mama's house. And it starts with a photograph captioned My Grandmother's Living Room. It's a very opulent living room. There's some Queen Anne furniture, cushy sofas, three of them, well spaced apart. And the tone is, they're gold walls and the tone of the fabric on the furniture is a peach colored and then some pink, rose colored and peach colored. There's some end tables. One has a peach colored tablecloth going down to the floor. There's a sofa table in the center of the room that is has spindled pleated kind of legs. And there are some books and some spode china upon that table, and then a bench in the middle of the room. And the bench has a cushion that matches the rug upon which the sofa table and bench stand. And that has that is again rose colored and beige colored tones. This room has double doors. Some to the right open out to a foyer, and there's a statue in that foyer in black and white tiles, and other double doors open out into a dining room. And there are windows all along, floor-to-ceiling windows on one side of the room. And then there's some other antique furniture. It appears to be perhaps an antique radio, a record player, antique clock on the wall, and some six-paneled painting, which you can't really discern, but it's of black and gold tones. All right, we'll start our essay. For a big chunk of my life, Christmas always started in my grandmother's living room. Her name was Heloise, but we called her Mama. And for years, I thought she was the only person in the world with that name. She and my grandfather, Mac, had three kids and seven grandkids. I'm the oldest. And their long-standing tradition was to have a seated dinner at their home in Memphis on Christmas Eve. It was a formal affair, which meant jackets and ties for me and my brother. I didn't love that part. But the trade-off was that we were allowed to open some presents from my aunts and uncles. It was, without a doubt, the most exciting night of the year, an event no one ever missed. Around 6 o'clock, usually after church, we would drive over in our station wagon with a plastic laundry basket loaded with gifts. We'd come in through the kitchen, where we were greeted by the smell of yeast rolls warming in the oven. The adults would have cocktails and cheese straws in the library, a ritual that seemed to go on forever, while the kids gobbled up the butterscotch candies Mama put out in the silver bowls. Our extended family didn't get together that often, but when we did, it felt like a party. My Aunt Marion's laughter could be heard throughout the house. Some years, right before dinner, Mama would take out her worn Bible and have the children read the Christmas story from the book of Luke, as a reminder of why we were all there. Eventually, we would make our way to the big dining table, which was set with a white linen tablecloth that had Christmas trees on it. There was a buffet with beef tenderloin, scalloped potatoes, and spinach casserole, plus basket after basket of rolls. In the early days, I wasn't that focused on the food because I was anxiously awaiting Mama's signal to go into the living room and open presents. That was the moment the holiday officially began. I don't know what it was about that space, but there was magic in it. Perhaps because Christmas Eve was the only time that we ever went in there. I can still picture my father and uncles lazing back on the couches, avoiding the fray, while my mother and aunts handed out gifts. The kids would tear into the packages, and Mama would sit on a bench at the center of the room, drinking coffee from a demitasse cup and taking it all in. When you'd give her something to open, she'd ask you to set it under the tree. "Oh, honey," she'd say, waving a hand at the chaos, "this is my Christmas present." Mama passed away in early 2020 at the age of 97, and the house was sold a few months later. I reached out to the real estate agent, asking for the photographs from the listing, and I like to look at them on occasion, especially around this time of year. I can still hear the laughter in that living room and see the floor littered with wrapping paper. And I'm always reminded of the many gifts my grandmother gave us. And that is signed Sid Evans, Editor-in-Chief. And listeners, you may reach him at Sid, S as in Sam, I, D as in David, at southernliving.com. And now, on to our story of the Southerner of the Year, the triumph of Lulu Griffin, how a teenage girl from Mountain Brook, Alabama, turned tragedy into purpose. This is by Boyce Upholt. And listeners, it begins with a full-page photo of a young woman sitting upon a four-legged brown stool. The background is a gray wall that has a light gray screen put upon it for this photograph. It's lit from the right side, and the young woman is facing to that side, kind of facing the light. And so we have her kind of a three-quarter profile. She is wearing a brown floral dress that's loosely tied at the waist. It's a V-neck, and there's a very tiny gold cross on a thin chain around her neck. She has long, dark brown hair, slightly wavy, straight at the top and waved at the bottom, and brown eyes and eyebrows, kind of an aquiline nose, aristocratic-looking nose. And she has a Mona Lisa smile. It's a definite smile, and there is definitely some mystery in it as well. Her sleeves are rolled up, and she has her right hand on her knee, and her right hand is wearing a silver chain bracelet. And that knee is a prosthetic knee. Her right leg is a prosthetic leg. She's wearing sneakers, white sneakers with yellow laces, and her dress stops just above her knee, and her left arm is amputated. Her left hand is amputated about an inch or two above where her wrist would be, and her sleeves are rolled up above her elbows. And here is her story. When a bull shark bit 15-year-old Lulu Griffin in Walton County, Florida, she could understand what was happening. It was cleaving her left arm and her right leg, but she did not feel any pain. I remember just thinking that the whole thing was a movie, Lulu says now, a year and a half after the attack. Certain details still stay crisp. Awakening amid a gaggle of onlookers and staring down at the strawberry-colored nail polish on her toes. There was also a tingling feeling as a heroic stranger, a quick-thinking nurse, used the drawstring from some swimming trunks to create an improvised tourniquet. Lulu's mental reel cuts off as she is being loaded into an ambulance. The next thing she remembers is waking up at the hospital, her first surgery complete. That violent day, June 7, 2024, was just the beginning, though. Before Lulu made it home to Mountain Brook, Alabama, 2.5 months later, she underwent 9 medical procedures. And throughout that process, there was pain. Searing, impossible pain. Located not within her body, but at the site of the missing appendages. Some nights, she woke up screaming. Pain can unmake a person's world, almost literally. You experience life as a story, one that's projected by and through your brain. And Lulu's brain simply couldn't comprehend what she'd lost. Describing the sensation of her phantom limbs, she says, "It's like your arm is squeezing you and stinging you and poking you." The rest of us will never grasp what she's endured. Her family, too, can only loosely outline the nature of their trauma. Lulu's twin sister, Ellie, was at her side, drifting on a wave, when the girls first heard someone cry, "Shark!" Ellie ran to find their mother, Ann Blair, in the crowd and said, "Mom, it's Lulu." Ann Blair says that Lulu's body, prone and ghost white, her leg gone, is something that they, quote, will never unsee ever in our lives. As I spoke with the Gribbons, I was struck by how they do not hesitate to return to those memories. Each has their own version. Ellie's tale starts hours earlier, before the attack, when the girls had found a staggering number of sand dollars. It was so cool, she says, the wonder of that moment untainted by what came later. Their father, Joe, recounts a confusing phone call and then the drive home from his office, his hazards blinking, the red lights no reason to stop. It wasn't yet clear to him what had happened. He only knew that things were bad. How from this shattering does a coherent story emerge? From my conversation with the family, one key turning point became clear. When Lulu awoke in that Pensacola hospital, her first words were, "I made it." That should have been impossible. Lulu had lost two-thirds of her blood. She knows she shouldn't be here. Really, she should not be here, Ann Blair says. But the strangers who pulled her to the shore and dressed her wounds allowed her to survive. In the hospital, the Gribbons reflected on that miracle, one that recast a tragedy as a triumph, a testament to the good in the world. A serious, gritty athlete, Lulu was ready to compete. Whatever pace her doctors prescribed for her recovery, she went faster. "I proved them wrong," she says. Joe notes that, rather than wondering why me, Lulu always thought, why not me? Her pain was not a marker of difference, but a unifier. We're all vulnerable. There is no human story without pain. Her progress was aided by top-flight doctors and access to cutting-edge technology. Patients sometimes don't get prosthesis until several months after their injuries. Then they're used to life without the prosthetic devices, Ann Blair says. That leads to a steep learning curve. Lulu, by contrast, was almost immediately given a prosthetic hand, which helped her brain adapt to her new conditions, reducing her phantom limb pains. Her first fittings for leg prostheses came soon thereafter. She was able to walk herself out of the hospital after 77 days. "That's unheard of," says Ann Blair. Back in Mountain Brook, Lulu was greeted with a homecoming parade that was decorated in purple, her favorite color. Thus began a strange new life. Her milestones since have included standard teenage rites of passage, like getting her driver's license, alongside bureaucratic benchmarks no child should have to contemplate, like her new knee being approved by insurers. The attack that made headlines across the world and the spotlight never shut off. There were flocks of reporters, like me, and an outpouring of support from athletes and celebrities, such as Caitlin Clark, Nick Saban, and Luke Bryan, plus hundreds of thousands of new Instagram followers. Lulu has embraced this attention. She's spoken to large crowds, appeared on national television, and even designed her own Ophelia swimwear collection. For many teenagers, such exposure might have been overwhelming, but Lulu has found it healing, saying that telling her story brings her joy. "It helps me cope," she adds. It's helping others, too. Lulu's tragedy might have been avoided had the family known that another beachgoer had been attacked around an hour earlier, just a few miles down the coast. But the system of communication at the time consisted of sheriffs putting up warning flags, a process that moved too slowly. So Alabama Senator Katie Britt proposed a new method akin to Amber Alerts, in which, after an attack, notifications would go out to phones located in the danger zone. Lulu's law passed in the U.S. Senate and is being considered in the House. The Gribbons also worked with state leaders to pass similar legislation that's already in effect in Alabama. She is proud of her law, but she's even more enthusiastic about the Lulu Strong Foundation, a nonprofit focused on improving the performance and affordability of high-grade prostheses, VR therapy, and related technologies. When people ask if she wishes she could go back and change things, she's never quite sure how to answer. "I just love the way that my life is now," she says. "I get to advocate for people with limb differences. I get to have a purpose with my life. And I get to have a relationship with God." For all that she lost, that day was a new beginning. A reminder that meaning isn't found in what the world takes from us, but in the story we weave from what remains. And we are almost out of time for today's episode of Southern Living. We hope you enjoyed it, and we hope you'll listen next time. I'm Joanna LaForgia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, we'd love to hear from you. Please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thanks so much for joining us, and so long till next time. Thank you.